This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Today we're joined by Professor Frank Close from the University of Oxford. He's a particle physicist. Welcome to Jodcast.
Hello.
And we're also joined by Niall McCallum, who's a newcomer to Jodcast, so welcome as well.
Hi there.
Frank, you just gave a really interesting talk at the Schuster Colloquium. But before we get into that, could you introduce yourself very quickly and tell us a little bit about your own research?
Well, I'm a particle physicist. I'm a theorist. I worked on quarks and gluons, the seeds of nuclear particles and the strong interactions, for many years. I was head of theory at Rutherford Lab. I spent 3 years at CERN in charge of the communications and public education, because I've always been interested in public education and public awareness of science. And then the last 10 years I've been at Oxford University, where I'm now just retired as professor. So I'm emeritus professor, which sounds great.
And in addition to all your research, you've given lots of public talks. You also gave a Royal Institution talk, a Christmas lecture.
Yes, I did. That was 22 years ago. Just last night, after a talk, I was in Sheffield, and afterwards a teacher came up and said he had brought his sixth formers, because when he was in the sixth form, he had heard me give the Christmas lectures and decided to take up physics, at which point I felt A, very old, and B, very humble. You know, that if you realised when you're doing these things that people are actually going to react to them, you probably would freeze.
All that time later, yeah. I don't know whether to say this, but it's back in 1993, so I was one.
Wow. Now I do really feel...
I'm sorry.
I hope you'll edit that out.
Yeah, we'll yeah, no, that was just a very good thing. You've also written a variety of books, and published a variety of books, including some short introductions to different areas of physics, vacuums and particle physics.
Yeah, one of them was called Nothing. Hmm. It was a book about nothing.
It's a brief introduction to nothing,
yes.
I think I read.
Yeah, and actually that's probably more fun than it might at first sight appear, though we did have them produce two volumes with nothing in them, completely blank pages. I've got one at home on my shelves, and somewhere out there is a blank copy waiting for somebody. I think that somebody must have bought it by now, and it shows that some people buy books and never read them, because there's nothing in it. But it's about the vacuum.
You'll find someone come up and find you and ask you to sign it one day.
Right.
So it's one of only two in existence.
But I can't sign it, because the moment my signature's in it...
It's void. Well, ooh, that's a... Yeah, but you've written some other books as well, and they all sort of provide an insight into some sort of area of progression of science, the history and what the field's like today. And you were here just giving a talk on your latest book, which is about Italian scientist Bruno Pontecorvo.
Yes, I mean, he's known as Mr. Neutrino. I think the background to today's talk is a book that I wrote called Neutrino, which was about Ray Davis, a man who spent 40 years of his life trying to detect neutrinos coming from the sun. And it took 40 years, and nobody believed that he was going to succeed. And even when he had done it, very few people believed him. But during the course, and he eventually got the Nobel Prize himself, he was 87
in 2002.
Mm. But while researching him, I discovered that behind the scenes, Bruno Pontecorvo was always present. And he's actually known as Mr. Neutrino. He has been widely believed to be the father of neutrino astronomy. Indeed, Ray Davis, in his Nobel speech, recognized that it was a paper that Pontecorvo had written in 1946 that inspired him to the idea that the sun could be producing neutrinos. But actually, the researches that I did found that the truth is a bit more complicated than that. We'll probably come back to that in a minute. The thing certainly that Pontecorvo did do, there were two things in neutrinos. One, that he is the man who had the insight that there's more than one variety of neutrino, electron neutrino and muon neutrino, that they're different. And in 1960, he came up with an experimental idea as to how to test that hypothesis. The problem was that by then he was in the Soviet Union. He disappeared through the Iron Curtain in 1950 for reasons which I find fascinating and was really the background to my book. But the fact that he was in the Soviet Union, there was no facility there that he could do the experiment at. And they refused him access. They were paranoid in those days. They refused to allow him to leave the Soviet Union to go to CERN, for example, where he could have done the experiment. So he had to write the experiment up. He had to write the idea up in Russian. It was published in a Russian journal, and it was about 2 years before the English translation arrived over in the West. And in the interim, in the States, T.D. Lee, I think it was, had had the basic idea independently, and Steinberger, Schwartz and Lederman then performed a famous experiment at Brookhaven, which confirmed that there are indeed two varieties of neutrino, and they got the Nobel Prize for that. So I think it is certainly plausible that Pontecorvo could have been a candidate or even a winner of the Nobel Prize had he not been prevented fulfilling that particular line of research, being in the Soviet Union as he was. The third idea that he had was that the supernova collapse. The theory, which we now know is true, but the theory was, electrons and protons in a star collapsing together, leaving you neutrons, which leaves a neutron star behind, emitting neutrinos in the process. And Pontecorvo had the insight that if this is correct, there would be that a supernova would shine 100 times brighter in neutrinos than it does even in light.
And we know how bright it is in light.
In light, I mean, it shines like a whole galaxy. And that these neutrinos would escape and in principle could be detected. And indeed, in 1987, when the supernova in the Magellanic Clouds was detected, it was also detected in, it created a blast of neutrinos that had crossed space and time for 180,000 light years or more. Passed through the Earth and was, some of these were picked up in detectors. And one of the experimentalists, Kashiba, shared the Nobel Prize with Ray Davis for that discovery. Pontecorvo sadly died in 1993, so had he survived, I think that he would have probably shared that Nobel Prize with Davis and Kashiba. And finally, his other great insight was that these two varieties of neutrino can, thanks to the wonders of quantum mechanics, flip backwards and forwards from one to the other. It's called neutrino oscillations. And this idea, which he had with Grieboff, was experimentally demonstrated within about the last 10 years ago. And it won the Nobel Prize this year. So I think that had he survived to be 102, which is getting a bit fanciful, but had he been around now, I think he probably would have shared that prize. So this shows that in the world of neutrinos, he was really extremely exciting and influential man. Having said all that, I did sort of leave hanging this thing that this popular wisdom that it was Pontecorvo who had the idea that the sun produces neutrinos. During my researches into his life, I discovered that it actually isn't true, that he was working in 1945, just after the war, at a nuclear reactor in Canada. And I think it was the idea that nuclear reactors can produce lots of neutrinos, and the fact that his mentor, Enrico Fermi, had postulated that neutrinos are produced in such things, that put those two ideas together in his head and made him think, oh, maybe a nuclear reactor is a place to go look for neutrinos. And he wrote a paper on how to look for the neutrino, which was still a hypothetical particle. And this paper was classified. They must have thought that, oh, this is a secret that, you know, people will out there be able to work out what nuclear power is coming from these power stations by detecting neutrinos, if only.
So it was locked up and banged away.
So it was locked up and banged away until 1964. I mean, why on earth this paper was classified for all that period, I've no idea. The following year, he wrote another paper. He gave a talk at a conference, which must have slipped through the net and was published. And in that paper, in 1946, he mentions the idea of the sun as a source of neutrinos. And that is the paper that everybody knows and has credited, and which I even mentioned in my little neutrino book. But the 1945 paper, which I've now seen finally in the archives, is just three pages long. It discusses ways of looking for the neutrino, and there's no mention in it at all of the sun as a source of neutrinos. Until you get to the very end. And at the end of the paper, it's signed off, Bruno Pontecorvo, and then there's a little addition, note. Dr. Maurice Price informs me that the sun could be a source of neutrinos, blah, blah, blah. So it's Maurice Price who had the idea. But then the next sentence is, however, the number of neutrinos arriving at Earth is only 10 to the 10 per square centimetre per second, which is too small for the sort of experiment designed here. So Maurice Price has suggested the idea, and the two of them had then dismissed it as possible. That's what the original story is. That was
so it came about as maybe a little whim. And then,
well, I think that what had happened probably in the confines of the laboratory, this had been discussed by the scientists for the next 12 months or so, and eventually these ideas matured, and Pontecorvo mentioned them at the open conference the following year, and they were then attributed totally to him, whereas in fact the provenance is more complicated.
I think, so we sort of take for granted now that the scientific community as a whole is quite unified, but I guess back when Pontecorvo was doing his work, which was between 1930 and about 1980, there was all sorts of stuff going on. He had a very interesting life. Was the sort of academic community split into the West? and the Soviet Union?
Well, they were, but that was not because they wanted to be. I think that the politics made it difficult to know what was going on in the Soviet Union and vice versa. But Podikovo's life was certainly very interesting, not least because he grew up in an interesting time. Mm. The world in the 1930s was very different than today, thankfully. Fascism was on the rise in Europe, and people had a decision to make. Were they fascist or were they anti-fascist? And intellectuals, for the most part, were anti-fascist. And the Communist Party was the one party that was taking an active move against that. Mm. So many intellectuals in the 30s became communists. The world changed post-war. By 1950, there was this hysteria against communists, especially in the United States with Senator McCarthy. And Oppenheimer, who was in charge of the atomic bomb project, is a classical example of somebody whose 1930s communist beliefs turned round and were used against him, and he was almost persecuted for that come the 1950s. So Ponti was working initially in Rome, where he made some very important discoveries in nuclear physics. In fact, the key to what is now a key to nuclear power, that when you slow neutrons down before they irradiate material, they're much more effective afterwards. He then went to Paris and worked with Joliot and Irene Curie, who had just won the Nobel Prize. And then, of course, the Nazis invaded France, and Ponti was an Italian in France, which meant he was on the enemy side. He was also from a Jewish background, which meant he was no friend of the Nazis either, so he had to flee.
So he had enemies to the left and right.
Absolutely. And he and his family escaped to North America, where he became an oil prospector. And that might sound a bit odd, but actually he brought nuclear physics to the oil industry by lowering a radioactive source that emitted neutrons down a borehole. The neutrons then irradiate the surrounding rocks and induce activity in them. And then by recording the activity and decoding it, you can work out what the rock strata are. And this method was able to distinguish oil-bearing shales from other rock forms.
And it was also used to distinguish uranium.
Absolutely. Mm. And he then was part of the Manhattan, on the periphery of the Manhattan Project, working at this nuclear reactor in Canada. And indeed, uranium deposits in Canada were found not least by using this technique that Pontecorvo himself had designed. He then, after the war, came back to Harwell in England, which was building the first nuclear reactor in the West. And then his colleague Klaus Fuchs was arrested for spying in 1950 in February. Pontecorvo himself was a member of the Communist Party, and with the anti-communist hysteria, he then began to get a bit nervous. And he told the authorities that he had relatives who were communists. So the authorities decided to sort of quarantine him from classified research, if you like. He was going to move to the University of Liverpool, where he could be a consultant, but would not be actively involved in the classified work. But then, at the end of his summer holiday, disappeared through the Iron Curtain. Disappeared off the face of the earth for 5 years. Nobody knew where he was. And then he resurfaced 5 years later.
Giving this conference that we discussed earlier.
Yes, that's right.
So his defection in 1950, do you think that that came about due to his unhappiness about being moved off classified information, the research that he was obviously so passionate about, and, well, the advent of the atomic age had pretty much consumed his entire research life, or was it more of a coercion?
I think a bit of both. You have to realise that at the political side, he was a communist in an era of anti-communist hysteria, which was not comfortable. He was being moved from classified research. It is possible that he was made aware of greater opportunities, that the Soviets were building this new laboratory at Dubna, which would have been, at that time, the most powerful accelerator around. This is before the time of CERN. And that may have been an attraction to him. He may have got wind of that through some contacts. But I'm also aware of the fact that there was some information passed to the Soviets from Chalk River, the lab that he was working at. This is not to say that he passed it. Somebody who's not been identified passed it. There are indirect hints that he had association with somebody who couriered information from there. I'm pretty sure, well, I know from a document that we found in the archives, that he almost certainly became aware of the fact that the FBI, for some reason, were interested in him and communist associations. And I think perhaps through the role of the infamous Kin Philby, who got wind of this, he became aware of this while he was on holiday. And so instead of returning home, they disappeared. And we found the airline manifests, which showed that he and the family went to the Soviet Union together, and they only took 60 kilograms of luggage with them in 10 cases. That's 6 kilograms a case. That's carry-on baggage. It's camping gear.
Which is what you went to do on holiday. So
which you take on holiday. If you're going to spend the rest of your life in the Soviet Union, your wife at least takes her fur coat with her.
Which they found later at her house.
Absolutely, yes.
So yeah, this is a fascinating story. And how did you go about your research? Is it still a sensitive topic to this day?
Well, interesting that, yes, in that the hydrogen bomb is still classified, surprisingly. And I was surprised because some of the things that Pontecorvo was aware of would have had interest to hydrogen bomb. And yet, in all of the inquiries that took place after he left, surprisingly, they covered everything, but not anything at all to do with hydrogen bomb. So I suspect that those papers have been withheld. It's not that they just goofed and overlooked it. Mm. So that is clear. How I did it? Well, in part, I'd always been interested in him as a scientist. I knew of him as a scientist. And I set out initially to write a biography of him as a scientist. And I then became aware that had he not gone to the Soviet Union, his career would have been even greater than it was. And as I said, he probably would have won a Nobel Prize, which he was prevented by him being there. So the question then was, so why did he go? And that became increasingly fascinating to me. And that I think I found the answers to. And at the end of it, I started off writing the book as a scientist, and it's ended up being on the shelves of military history in some of the bookstores, which is rather unusual.
It almost comes across as a thriller.
It is, actually. One of the reviews said it has a Le Carré-esque cast of characters. And yes, it is a thriller. I read it through and I think, well, is there any science in this? And actually, yes, there is. I mean, I deliberately had a couple of chapters devoted specifically to his science, not least the fact that thanks to his son, who was 2 years old when Bruno fled the Nazis and 12 years old when they disappeared through the Iron Curtain, he's a retired nuclear physicist
who I've contacted
in Dubna, he managed to get hold of the logbooks, which show that during that first 5 years in Dubna, he had some very seminal ideas, which he never really got fully credited for. The concept of associated production, which is when cosmic rays hit the atmosphere, they produce what's called strange particles in a very odd way. That's why they're called strange. And Ponty had the insight that they were produced in pairs. This is called associated production. This idea is traditionally attributed to Gell-Mann and Pice over here in the West. But looking at those logbooks, I think Ponty had that idea independently about 6 months before them. The concept of strangeness, which is the important feature which it spawned, however, he didn't understand that particular aspect. So I think it would be going too far to say that he should have been credited with strangeness, but the idea of associated production he certainly had. And there were some other insights that he had as well, which, being in the Soviet Union, he never really got credit for, and also being classified and hidden for some period of time, never came to light.
It is really interesting that he may have, part of the reason that he may have left for the Soviet Union is to take advantage of the state-of-the-art technology they're developing. But then, due to him going, he may have been limited in other ways, which has prevented...
Yes, I think that is the great irony. I mean, there's an enigma. What he said to an interviewer just shortly before his death was that he refused an interview on the grounds that, I want to be remembered as a great physicist, not as your f***ing spy. That's literally what he said. And depending on how he intoned that, it's an admission that he spied. And that really he wanted to be known as the great physicist, and that he had been messed up because of that. Or he was fed up with being accused of spying when in fact he was nothing other than the great physicist. And of course that we will never know. But it's a great irony, however, it turns out that if he was indeed totally innocent of espionage and went out there for personal reasons, for the belief that perhaps he could do better physics in the Soviet Union, well, of course, we'll never know what would have happened had he been over here. Ideas don't just come automatically. They come out of conversations, and he may have had different conversations. So that we will never know. But certainly the life that he had was certainly a disaster for his wife, without any doubt. And I think his science did overall... He didn't get the credit probably that he might have done.
And was he ever reconciled with his family after all of this, many years later?
Many years later, well, he never saw his parents again, and his wife never saw her parents again. That was part of the tragedy of the things.
As you mentioned in your talk, his wife had a breakdown.
Yes, she did. About 28 years later, finally, he was allowed to leave the Soviet Union and make contact with family again.
Mm.
So, overall, I think it's a tragic story. It's
a tragic but fascinating story. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
If you wanted to get it for Christmas, it's Half-Life.
I'm tempted to get it for my dad.
Right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.